got me, Tommy. Ended that song, and I took a step forward, and then you were like, no, let's sing a little other verse here. Totally faked me out. Totally faked me out. Yeah, I do. I know. Appreciate, man, great singing this morning. Absolutely great. And appreciated Sam's thought for the Lord's Supper and Wesley's scripture reading. It's just been a great morning to go along with our appointment of new elders. And I am super thankful for both of the men that you all have selected and have been brought into our eldership. Both Steve and David, I think, will do okay. And so that's a pretty good vote of confidence. It's a great time to be a part of the Forest Mill Church of Christ. So many good things going on. Looking forward to seeing what God has in store for us going forward. I read a story this week about a guy who he lived further north, and up there they get lots of snow, and every time it snowed, the snowplow would just take out his mailbox. And it was only his mailbox, like on the whole road, the whole street, it was just his mailbox. And to be clear, it happened so often that it was obvious it was happening intentionally. The driver, for some reason, no one knows why, was targeting this guy's mailbox and would just mow it down. And so the owner of the mailbox, he was calling the Department of Transportation, and he would complain about it, and he just got excuse after excuse that basically amounted to, it's not our fault, you have a delicate mailbox, right? So fast forward to the following winter, and the first decent snow starts falling. It's right about 4:30 a.m. that the whole neighborhood gets woken up by this huge, loud, metallic clang and the screech of tearing metal. And standing outside was one very totaled and almost ripped in half snowplow. Because as it turned out, over the summer, this guy had gotten himself a backhoe and had sank an I-beam into the ground in his front yard. He then covered it with a decorative wood sleeve and topped it with a brand new mailbox. So when the snowplow driver tried to mow it down, it was one of those cases of an immovable object meets an unstoppable force, and in this case, the immovable object won. So the snowplow is now firmly impaled on the I-beam, and you could clearly now see that he had gone out of his way to hit this mailbox. Naturally, the Department of Transportation was none too happy about it, and they tried to get him to pay for the damage, and the man's response was, it's not my fault you have a delicate snowplow. It's pretty rewarding when we see somebody get, we call it their just desserts, right? It's rewarding to see that. We generally like it when those who hurt us or injure us or the people we love, when they are paid back in kind, it feels pretty good. And if that's you, if you can relate to that sentiment, then Obadiah is the book for you. Because Obadiah is absolutely, it's short, by the way. Obadiah is one chapter. It's the shortest book in the Old Testament. And it's really small, but it's really filled with emotion once you kind of understand what's going on here. And it also offers us some guidelines for those emotions when we're in that sort of situation. So let me just give you the background, just a real quick history lesson. We're not positive, by the way, when Obadiah was written, because he doesn't give us any of the traditional historical markers. You read Obadiah, you're not going to find that so-and-so was the king or here, or so-and-so was the king there. He's not going to reference any specific historical events. But when you sort of read between the lines who he's addressing and what it's about, it seems that this is likely written sometime after the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. And that is a really important date in the history of Judah and Jerusalem, because that was 586 was the year Jerusalem was destroyed by the Babylonians. Now, you may remember, as we've been going through the minor prophets, God has been promising that judgment is coming. to Judah, to Jerusalem, because of their sins, right? There was idolatry, there was greed, there was taking advantage of the poor, there was abuse and neglect and immorality. There was all these sins that had been going on in Judah and Jerusalem, and they'd watched everybody else have to pay the price for their sins, and somehow they'd stood apart. They haven't, so they're thinking, we're special, not going to happen to us. Well, it happened to them. And in 586, Babylon successfully defeated Judah and Jerusalem. And they carried off. When they go in, they don't just win a battle. I mean, this is utter annihilation, right? They carry off all the riches. They captured all the leaders and the important people, all the scholars, and lots of people. They captured almost all the people, and they made them slaves in Babylon. And significantly, they burned everything in the process, burned everything to the ground. So there's, you go into Jerusalem, there's no longer homes, there's no businesses, there's no vineyards, there's no farms, and most importantly, no temple. It's all gone. And when this happened to Jerusalem, Edom, now Edom, if you remember, it's a small nation just to their south. And this small nation that was related to Judah and Israel, dating all the way back to Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the founding father, so to speak, of Israel. And Esau was the founding father, so to speak, of Edom. These nations come from these twin brothers. And Jacob and Esau didn't get along even when they were in the womb. They didn't get along when they were kids. They didn't get along when they were young adults. They didn't get along when they were old adults. They kind of respectfully passed one another on one occasion. But other than that, they largely did not get along. So here, after generations and generations and generations, this animosity has continued. They were a holdout when the people of Israel came in to conquer the Promised Land. Edom sort of was a holdout. And then eventually, King David subdued it, and he made them a vassal state where they were paying tribute, and they lived there. But then they usurped that authority, and they got out from under it. And so they had just sort of been yang. You know how family members are that you don't get along with. They'd been back and forth for generation after generation after generation. So along comes the Babylonians. They're threatening Judah and Jerusalem. And what does Edom do? Edom watched with glee as Jerusalem was destroyed. Not only that, they cheered it on, right? And then they participated in the looting. The city's getting looted. There's Edom right there looting the city. And when the refugees come to Edom for sanctuary, for refuge, Edom rounds them up and says, oh, Babylon, you forgot some people over here, and gives them back. That's what Edom did. Edom, who is related to Israel through Isaac and Rebekah, stood by and watched as their kinsmen were destroyed. So when God sends this message, this book of Obadiah, when God sends this message of Obadiah, which is a prophecy against Edom, the people of Judah are there for it. I mean, they're like, let's see what God has to say to Edom. And this is what God says to Edom. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, rise, let us go against her for battle. So battle's coming to Edom now, right? See, I will make you small among the nations, and you will be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks, and who make your home on the heights. You who say to yourself, who can bring us down to the ground? Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. So Edom, in case you haven't figured out, it's kind of a mountainous region. It's got these big red cliffs, and their capital city, their biggest city, was sort of built into this mountainous region. And so because of where they were and sort of their geographical preference. Their symbol was an eagle among the stars. That was sort of their national symbol. And they were like, we're way up here. You can't come get us. Edom, who rejoiced in the tragedy of Jerusalem, and now we find out that not only had the Israelites not forgotten about it, God had not forgotten about it either. So now God says, the same things that happened, or same things that you cheered on in Jerusalem, those things are going to happen to you. Listen to this. It's written about several times in the Old Testament. I just wanted to pull a couple of pertinent references. Psalm 137, verse 7. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem. So God, remember what Edomites did when Jerusalem was destroyed, how they said, lay it bare down to the foundations, or raise it. We might use the term to raise something, right? Imagine taking a big old bulldozer and just scraping it all the way down to the concrete foundation. That's what they were calling for. They're up there cheering, destroy it, cheer it on. And so they were standing by as Jerusalem was destroyed. They cheered on the conquering Babylonians, and now the tables are going to be turned. They are going to be conquered. Their cities are going to be burned to the ground. Their people are going to be captured as slaves. All their wealth is going to be carried off, and no one is going to step up and help them. The same way they didn't step up to help Israel, Judah, no one's going to step up and help Edom. Now, I often say as a corrective, because people think this, if you don't know the Bible very well, you think the idea of karma is in the Bible. Is anybody familiar with the idea of karma? You know what that is? You know, what goes around comes around sort of thing? I often have said that it's not in Scripture, that idea is unbiblical. But this is pretty close. Down in verse 15, God goes on to say, the day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head. So that's the whole book of Obadiah. I mean, that's a summary of the whole book of Obadiah. There's also in there some hope for the people of Israel, talking about how God is going to bring them back and make them prosper, and he's going to make Jerusalem great again and all those things. All that's in there. But I want us to think for just a second, because this is largely a prophecy against the nation of Edom. That's the whole purpose of the book of Obadiah. What exactly was Edom punished for? Let's think about this, right? What did Edom do that was so wrong? They weren't the reason Jerusalem was destroyed. They weren't the ones to destroy it. They weren't the ones who attacked the city. They weren't the ones who burned the city. They were not responsible for the fate of the people of Judah. They're not the ones who did that. They didn't do it. They just stood by while it happened, right? So, as we say from the New Testament, what they did was not a sin of commission. We would call it a sin of omission. It's not what they did. It's what they didn't do. Or, yeah, another great country song. It's not what I did. It's what I didn't do. Have you ever thought about that? Like, what's so bad about not helping? Well, this sin of omission, of not helping, is still a sin. And here's the principle I want you to take from this morning. Because as the people of God, we are called to stand with our neighbors when they are hurting, not stand by as they're hurting. That's the principle. When you see, meet, know, encounter someone who's hurting, you are called to stand with them, not stand by as it happens to them. That's the biblical principle for this morning. You may have heard of the idea of Samaritan laws. Good Samaritan laws, right? Good Samaritan laws are those who, they're supposed to protect you if you're trying to help someone. I had to learn about when I was a volunteer fireman years ago. and they were teaching us about CPR. And you've got to learn to do CPR. And if you do CPR right, you can hurt someone. If you're doing it right, you can hurt someone, right? You can crack a rib or a sternum, and you could potentially hurt them. So for that reason, some people are like, look, I'd like to help, but I don't want to get in trouble if I hurt, right? And if you imagine you're walking down along the square and you see somebody collapse and they're having a heart attack or something's going on, you think, oh no, this person needs CPR. If you thought you could be sued for helping them, for trying to help them, you're a lot less likely to help them. And this goes all the way back in the U.S. to the 1959, kind of a famous 1959 case where someone was crying out for help all night long and eventually died because no one wanted to get involved because they were afraid of the consequences of getting involved. So across the U.S., different municipalities and states passed these Good Samaritan laws where if you try to help someone, even if it goes horribly south, if you're doing something reasonable, right, you can't say, I was trying to help when I cut off their head. You can't, that's not a valid defense. But if you say, I was trying to help when I gave CPR, I was trying to help when I put them in my car to carry them to the hospital, I was trying to help and something bad happened and they got hurt worse, you can't be sued. Now, the idea for Good Samaritan laws, even the name for them, it goes back to a pretty famous parable that Jesus told, we call it the parable of the Good Samaritan. And in the parable of the Good Samaritan, just to sort of summarize it, there was a guy who was on a trip, and he's out in the countryside, but, you know, the countryside in their day is a pretty dangerous place to be. It's where you could get beaten up and robbed, and that's what happened to him. So he gets beaten up, he gets robbed, he gets sort of left for dead on the side of the road. And as he's lying there on the side of the road, and he's, you know, we would say he's in bad shape. If nobody helps him, he's going to die. Along comes two different people who see him, who recognize his plight, and who pass by on the other side. Now, that's not the role of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan sees him, helps him, carries him, puts him up, restores him to full health. But I think as a church, as a Christian, sometimes I relate more to those first two guys. How much easier is it in your life to just see it and go, look, I've already got enough on my plate. Look, I don't have great medical knowledge. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to help this person financially. I'm not a counselor. I can't help them with their relationships. I've got a pocket full of ready excuses to not help people in need. Do you have those? You ever have a conversation with someone, you're like, ooh, this is more than I can do. In fact, I've had a conversation with Susie who helps people, and most of the people Susie tries to help are more than she can do. Because they're facing circumstances she's never been through, and she's like, I don't know what to do. Our benevolence committee is the same way. They're trying to get involved in the lives of people who are going through something they've never been through. It's really hard. And when we meet and encounter and sometimes even love people who are going through difficult circumstances, it's so much easier to be like Edom. Even if we don't rejoice at their downfall, we at least pass by on the other side and just sort of let it happen to them. Not my fault, not my responsibility, let it happen to them. But the book of Obadiah, in addition to being sort of a warning to Edom, it's also a reminder to Jerusalem that this happened to you, and now punishment is befallen you. So don't you fall into the same trap of thinking you can act like that without consequence. I remember being in school, and every once in a while, especially towards the beginning of the school year, someone would do something and they would get like, it seemed like a disproportionate amount of punishment for it, you know? It would seem like the teacher or the principal or whoever was handling the punishment for somebody doing something, it would seem pretty disproportionate. And the general rule was you knew They were making an example out of that person so that you did not do likewise. So something that might pass by under the radar later gets really noticed early on. God treats Edom with such harshness because he does not want his people to act like that. He does not want those who call themselves the people of God to behave like the people of the world. We see what happened to Edom. We don't want that to happen to us. I cannot just be a person who passes by. I cannot just be someone who stands by as people are hurting. I've got to be someone who stands with the people who are hurting. And this morning, maybe you are the person who's hurting. Maybe you are going through or have gone through terrible difficulties, beyond your control difficulties. And you felt like life is unfair, life is unjust, like the people of Israel felt. You can know this morning that there is a day coming when God's going to make all of that right, that every bit of that is going to be made right. And I want you to know that as a congregation, we want to stand with you as you struggle. Or this morning, maybe you're a Christian already, and your life is sort of uncomplicated the way you like it, and it's so much easier to just let that all pass by you. My prayer for you, my prayer for us as a congregation, is that we will be, as the people of God who are called to be, those who stand with the hurting and fallen. If we can encourage you, lift you up this morning, won't you come now as we stand? As we sing.